Morning. Does someone have a program they can give me? Thanks. So, this morning I'm going to talk about, guess what, for those of you who've been with me for a while, faith, heart, mind, inscription. I've been going line through this 7th century poem, and it seems to go on forever. Maybe it will. So I think I'm going to read it. I'm going to read the lines I'm going to talk about today first. And this is where I left off last time. Dreams, delusions, flowers of air. Foolish to try to grasp them. Gain and loss, right and wrong, away with them once and for all. If the eye does not sleep, all dreaming ceases naturally. If the mind makes no discrimination, the 10,000 things are as they are, of single essence within the deep mystery of things as they are. We are released. I see the lines are wrong here. Within the deep mystery of things as they are, we are released from our relationship to them. So these phrases together remind me of Katagiri Roshi's expression, the pivot of nothingness. So I want to talk about a little bit today about how I think they manifest that spirit. And I want to talk about that using bodhisattvas. Since in practice period we've been studying bodhisattva archetypes a little bit, and since we have a Taigen Leighton coming next Saturday, for those of you who can come to do a workshop on engaged Buddhism, and he's the one who's done, the best work with bodhisattva archetypes. This book, Faces of Compassion, is a few years old. But when he speaks next week, he's going to speak about the sequel to that in terms of the work that he's done in engaged Buddhism. I'm not going to talk about that today, but I just have the archetypes on my mind, so why not? Why not? Okay, so let's start with the first one. Dreams, delusions, flowers of air. If we think about it, we think it's often it's a negative expression, but it's not. It's a very beautiful, positive expression. Dreams, delusions, flowers of air. What are we as human beings but dreaming, deluded, creating flowers of air? What are we? That's mostly what human beings are, isn't it? Dreams, delusions, and flowers of air. So to try to cut that off or negate that or even transcend that is to transcend our own humanness. So this is something wonderful that we can create flowers of air. Dogs can't do that. At least, I don't know, most dogs can't do that. Maybe some dogs can do that. But we have that unique ability to create a flower in the air, out of air. And that's the archetype there is Maitreya Buddha. Maitreya Buddha. Maitreya Bodhisattva, who knows that he will become a Buddha, because Shakyamuni tells him he'll become a Buddha in the future. So then he envisions himself as a Buddha. He envisions himself as acting with calmness, as acting with kindness. He becomes then an icon in Buddhist mythology that appears again and again and again. And Maitreya comes from Maitri, which means loving kindness. So he is the icon of hope, of intentionality, the second step on the Eightfold Path, intentionality, complete intentionality to manifest something. And so Maitreya is a key to our practice. And Maitreya helps us when we're despondent, when we think, I screwed this up, I screwed that up. This relationship is not going well, my practice is not going well. And Maitreya says, return to the pivot of nothingness and dream again. Dream again. don't give up. I'm here as the Bodhisattva to encourage you to do that, to reignite your dream, to start over and do it again, time and time and time again, regardless of how discouraged you are, coming back to the pivot of nothingness. So there are all kinds of visualizations, practices associated with Maitreya, especially the Tibetans are into that. Stopped. All kinds of because we visualize what we want to create, what we want to be. And that visualization can be very helpful to us. We need that as human beings. And then, of course, we goof it all up, and we get discouraged, and we want to give up. But that's when we need to come back just to the pivot of nothingness and let it come out again. It'll come out. There'll be a new vision, a new dream will come out. And Dogen says, without expressing dreams, there are no Buddhas. Dogen says, the expressing a dream within a dream is all Buddhas. All Buddhas. And Tigan Leighton suggests exemplars of different bodhisattvas. And for him, an exemplar of Maitreya Buddha is Joanna Macy. How many of you know the work of Joanna Macy? A few of you. Because Joanna Macy, one of her first things was to... she's a Buddhist practitioner for years, and she was really concerned about how to store nuclear waste. Everybody was discouraged about that. Nobody had a vision or an idea about how to do that. So she began hanging out with scientists and learning something about this whole problem, and then began helping them envision how to do it. So she definitely, I agree with Taigen as an example of Maitreya. And she went into Tibetan refugee camps at the very beginning when the Tibetans in India were really, really having a hard time. Before they had sort of reunited, as I think they have for the most part, she went into those camps and reminded them about Maitreya. But she didn't remind them by telling about the mythology, because they knew about the mythology, but by helping them create a vision for themselves about, well, there was this place called the United States, for instance, and it had these kind of features, and some of them could stay in India in their lives. So she helped them envision. She helped them envision a future. And she didn't need to do that for too long, because they then went back to their own Buddhist practice. Not that they'd ever given it up, but they had such an awful time. Human beings, what we do to each other, they almost experienced a kind of a cultural genocide. They got out in time, many of them. And so my other exemplar for this morning will be Katagiri Roshi, the head teacher here for lots of years. So when I first met him, many, many, many years ago, let's say 40, but it was longer than that, he was young, and he had just come from Japan, and he said, I heard him give a talk in very broken English, and he talked about dim vision, coming back to dim vision, and planting seeds and coming back to dim vision, that the seeds might grow, that one or the two of the seeds might grow. And so I saw him then, and then I was practiced with him, and then I was living here, and I heard that he was up to be the head teacher in San Francisco, but he didn't get it. Somebody else was selected. Suzuki Roshi had a Dharma heir who became the head teacher. So Katagiri Roshi, who had been raiding for all this time, all the students were this other fellow's. And so there he was, on the edge. And he'd had to stand and watch Suzuki be this in the limelight for all these years. And then this other guy came. So somebody from Minnesota invited Katagiri out here, right? This story is actually much longer. I'm just doing a very abbreviated version. So he thought, oh, well. And when he came here, and I think I first saw him in something like, when he came again here, maybe 1973, something like that, 30 years ago, well, you know, whatever, 30 years ago. And he said, I heard him give his talk, and he said, I want to plant seeds, just a few seeds. Maybe something will grow. And I thought, oh yes, that's his dim vision. His dim vision. And a few years later, he ordained me and Norm to be priests, you know, the first Zen priests in the Midwest, right? We were his dim vision, right? But we dimmed out of it. First I dropped out, and then Norm dropped out. Well, he had to keep planting seeds. Some of those seeds just didn't do anything. A few of them sprouted. But then a few more people dropped out. But then, and then he got cancer, as you know. He got cancer. And my friend, one of my dropout friends, because there were more than two of us who dropped out. One of my dropout friends, who's a Zen teacher now, went to visit him in the hospital when he had cancer. And Katagiri Roshi said, yes, I want to teach Dogen. There are these certain fascicles of Dogen. As soon as I get out of the hospital, I'm going to teach them because I want to help people return to the pivot of nothingness. They will have a life if they do that. I just want to do that. Of course, he never could. The cancer ate him away and he died. But now, if you look at Zen in the United States, those of you who... those seeds have sprouted all over the Midwest, the West Coast, the East Coast. When I was with the Zen teachers 2 years ago in Oregon, there were about 50 Zen teachers there, and I would say half of them came up to me and said, oh, you were Katagiri Roshi's disciple? Of course, they didn't know I was his dropout disciple. And they said, Minnesota Zen Meditation Center? Like this. Ooh! It's true. It's true. So, the dim vision. The dim vision. You can always dream. It's never too late. It's never too late. So that's the first line. Dreams, delusions, flowers of air. But then the second line, we have to have a new bodhisattva come in. Dreams, delusions, flowers of air. Foolish to try to grasp them. Gain and loss, right and wrong. Away with them once and for all. Which bodhisattva is that? Which bodhisattva is that? Right. You got it. Manjushri. Manjushri needs to clean things up a little bit because we get so attached. We get so fixated on our dream. The problem isn't the dream. The dream is wonderful. The problem is the anxiety about the fixation. Then we have to return to the pivot of nothingness, which is right here always. Always right here. If we return to it, we're okay. So Manjushri has a very sharp sword, right? And what else does Manjushri have? A book. Not to teach us new stuff, but to use his words to deconstruct our stuff. The turning words, we call that in Zen. The words which go right into us and just detach us from all our stuff. When we're in a receptive state, you have to be in a receptive state. So Manjushri, with his sword in one hand and with his book in the other hand, he unpacks, he deconstructs right from the pivot. So now another story. This story I've told before many times, but probably not for a year or two. And some of you don't have very good memories. So some of your memories are getting worse, like mine. Some of them may be getting better, but I don't think Zazen helps your memory, frankly. It helps you in lots of ways, but don't expect it to help your memory. So I was with my teacher Suzuki Roshi, and I had spent time at the Zen monastery in Tassajara, and I wanted to deepen my practice. We always want to deepen our practice, right? We don't want to attain something, because that sounds kind of crude. We may think that, but deep doesn't sound crude, you know? It doesn't sound crass, but it just sounds like deep. Right? So I wanted to deepen my practice by going to Japan, because a couple of little big guys had gone to Japan, and I want to be a big guy, too. I still haven't made that, but you never know. It's always possible. I can always dream. A couple of the big guys had gone to Japan, and so I wanted to go to Japan and practice Zen. Tassajara was beautiful, but I wanted to go to my teacher's temple, be there. But then I started thinking about where I would go, and started dreaming about it, talking to people about it, developing a vision of a place where there weren't too many tourists. Tourists come to Zen monasteries in Japan a lot. They didn't want to be there, and where they didn't do a ritual all day, where they did sitting. Some of the Zen temples, they're too busy with their guests to do sitting, or they're too busy with ritual to do sitting. I didn't want to go to those. So I remember that I tried calling Gary Snyder. I did a bunch of things, talking to people who, and I was ruminating about it. I didn't think that I was fixated on it. And so I was having breakfast with my teacher one morning. And I think I must have said something to him. Well, I heard this about Antaiji, but in comparison with a Heiji, it had these weaknesses and these strengths, and then compared with Sojiji, and some of you remember this story. And then he just listened to me, and we finished our breakfast. And then there were some raku. You know what raku pottery is? Some of you know what raku pottery is. Well, there was raku pottery around. That's what he liked, and raku pottery cups and bowls. And he said, if you try to find the best one of these, you will never appreciate any of them. That's all he said to me. You know, he never said much to me, actually. I kind of gulped, and I went home, and I just kind of thought about that, and I took some deep breaths, and then after a while, I just thought, I gave up. I just let it go entirely, and I didn't forgot thinking about going to Japan and just stayed with him. So, turning words. This is what the teachers have been doing with us, those of us who are really sincere about this practice for centuries, and what they continue to do, turning words, to help us. In that case, he was being Manjushri, but he didn't have any sword. But it affected me that way. I thought, oh, I won't use the profanity that I thought. But and then I saw what I'd been doing. Which isn't bad. Human beings do that all the time. But he was trying to show me something deeper, right? So, raku pottery, appreciated. This is not really raku pottery, but it has some of the qualities of raku pottery. Appreciated for its coarseness, for its irregularity, for its simplicity, and for its cracks. You know, they like to just put it in the oven and then have the cracks just be the cracks. Gain and loss, right and wrong, away with them once and for all. The eye does not sleep. All dreaming ceases naturally. If the eye does not sleep, all dreaming ceases naturally. So this is Manjushri telling us that when we wake up from our exclusive ego-based dreaming, exclusively ego-based dreaming, which one moment is a dream and the other moment is a nightmare, That's how we know it's exclusively ego-based, because it's moving quickly. It's like, almost for me, my plans had for Japan had turned into a nightmare. Because I couldn't find the right place. And I was going to give all this money, all this time, my whole life. And I was getting conflicting messages. I couldn't. But when we wake from our sleep, from our exclusive ego dream, then glory and disgrace, gain and loss, up and down, deep and shallow, they just vanish of themselves. That's what Manjushri does. He just, with his nice sword, he just cuts it all away. He just cuts it all away. It's a smooth cut. It's a smooth cut. So Manjushri's cutting away prepares the scene for the next bodhisattva on my list today. This is just my own list, you know. Who do you think Manjushri prepares himself for? Who's Manjushri go along with? Who is his partner in Buddhist thought? Who's Manjushri's partner? Pardon? That's right. Avalokiteshvara is on one side, Manjushri is on the other side. In most iconography, not in all of it. And in many temples. Not in this temple. So Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, right? Compassion. The sense being here that we need to deconstruct all of our thoughts about compassion to really experience compassion. We need to unpack them. Because too much of our compassion is caught up with our ideas about who we should be and who we have been, or being good, or we empathize so much with someone's problems that we get confused by their problems, that their problems are so much our problems that we lose our center. We have to come back to the pivot of nothingness then. So that then we can experience the real compassion, which just emanates from the pivot. It just emanates from the pivot. That's Avalokiteshvara. That's unconditional positive regard before there were any psychologists. That's active listening before there was Freud. 2,000 years before Freud, right? And it's not a technique. It comes from the pivot of nothingness. It's not something you have to go to school to learn. It's your nature. It's your nature. So Avalokiteshvara comes in wherever there's suffering and is there personally, just there personally, directly. And Taigen Layton uses Mother Teresa as one of his exemplars of Avalokiteshvara. I think Mother Teresa is a good exemplar, but I don't know that much about her. And then, of course, I have another exemplar. And, you know, I am fixated on my teacher, so. So my exemplar, is Suzuki Roshi, with a story that I have not told yet. Probably not told yet. You would think that I would have told them all by now. I may have told this. Years ago, when I was with my teacher, there was a famous Raku potter who came to San Francisco. And he was going to give a talk on his pottery, because he had an interpreter. He didn't speak English. He was going to give a talk on Raku pottery. So we wanted to go, me and my friends, and Suzuki wanted to go. You know, at that time our sangha was very small. On a Sunday we would have less people than this, actually. And I lived right across the street from my teacher, so. And, So they wanted to go. So we were going to go to the lecture at the something or other museum on Raku Pavari, and there were four of us who were going to go, and we were going to drive Suzuki, who didn't drive, and then the morning came to go, and it turned out that there were only three of us in him, and I said, "Where is Ruth?" Ruth was going to be the fourth one. And one of the other guys said, "Ruth's having a hard time today. She's not up for it." Ruth was my friend, and she was a sincere student, but she struggled a lot with hopelessness and with a sense of despair. A lot of hopelessness and despair. She was a wonderful person, but she just struggled with it. And in those days, nobody got diagnosed. There were no meds or anything like that. At least I didn't know about them. Maybe there were. So it was a different world, right? But the same people, same human beings. And so Ruth didn't come with us. And so we got to the lecture. We got to the talk, and we got seats kind of in front, and all sat down. And then just before the talk started, I saw Suzuki Roshi leave. And we're sitting, listening to the talk, the interpreter interpreting, because I couldn't understand the guy. The guy showing some nice Raku pottery and talking about it. And it was good. I liked it. But I wondered, where's Suzuki Roshi? Then the talk is about three quarters of the way through, he comes back in and takes his seat. And at the end, I said, "Well, you missed three quarters of the talk." He said, "Yes, but look what I got." And he said, "I got this for Ruth." And he had gone to the gift shop, which was downstairs, and he had found a little card, a Raku pottery card, with a beautiful picture of a Raku bowl, and he'd gotten it for Ruth. So he had his little bag, which he put in his little carry things in the way Japanese do. Took it home, and I guess he gave it to Ruth. So that's a story of my first teacher as an Avalokiteshvara exemplar. And if the eye does not sleep, all dreams cease naturally. Naturally, if you do this practice of just sitting still, just being where you are, you won't be captured by your dreams. And it'll just happen. It'll sneak up on you. It'll happen when you least expect it. When you most expect it, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I promise you. It's when you least expect it. If the eye does not sleep, all dreaming ceases naturally. Now the last two lines, moving on to another bodhisattva. If the mind makes no discrimination, the 10,000 things are as they are, of single essence. Within the deep mystery of this, things as they are, we are released from our relations to them. Anybody want to guess who that bodhisattva is? Maybe a little bit harder one to guess. Samantabhadra bodhisattva. Undoubtedly Samantabhadra bodhisattva. Samantabhadra bodhisattva comes from the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra. Huayin Buddhism all comes out of Samantabhadra, and the Avatamsaka Sutra is really thick. Avatamsaka and Samantabhadra is cruising around in it, so you can't even find your way. But he's the teacher of interconnectedness. He's the teacher of interconnectedness. He dwells in the interconnected realm, which is right here, but his consciousness is in that realm. Indra's net is one of his expressions. And he's considered to be in the ocean mirror samadhi, throughout the whole Avatamsaka Sutra, which is hard to read. You'll maybe fall asleep and get bored and need to get some stimulant or some sedative. If you just open a page and read from it, it's cool. But if you try to read it from end to end, good luck. Ocean mirror samadhi. Ocean mirror. The ocean is still. The ocean is still. It mirrors everything. It mirrors the clouds, the lightning, the thunder, the doves, the eagles, the hawks, the sparrows are all mirrored in the ocean. So that little sparrow that's in the ocean is completely itself. And yet, the whole ocean is what it is. If you look at the whole ocean, it's everything. So individual and undivided. Individual and undivided. Not one or the other. Don't think one or the other. You've been thinking one or the other too long and you're getting exhausted. You don't need to exhaust yourself. Individual is undivided. That's why it's called the ocean mirror samadhi. That's your natural state of mind. It's also called the ocean seal samadhi because that little sparrow that's hovering over that little bit of ocean, the ocean, as it reflects that sparrow, seals his existence just as he is. He doesn't have to be anything else. He doesn't have to try to be an eagle. He doesn't have to wish he were something else. He's just sealed by that mirror, which is all of life. Authenticity. Authenticity. That's what Samanta Bhadra teaches us about. But not authenticity through something psychological. I'm not talking about that. This is not psychological. Well, it is psychological, but not. Well, it's kind of psychological, but you can't technique it. You can't technique it. So Samanta Bhadra appears in all realms. There's a Samanta Bhadra in every realm. Even in a tip of grass, there's a Samanta Bhadra. Samanta Bhadra doesn't discriminate between animate and inanimate. He's in all realms. She's in all realms. And Samanta Bhadra's body radiates vibrancy and dignity within every pore. Pore. P-O-R-E, every pore. Light flashing out, supposedly. A little bit of drama here. Keeps me awake when I'm trying to read it at 10:30 at night. To be a good teacher, I try to read all these books. I think I'm going to cut that out. So Samanta Bhadra, here's my hand, here's my thumb. The thumb is completely just the thumb. It has a unique function here, unique function. It doesn't have this function, it doesn't have this function, it doesn't have this. It has this function. And yet, it has no relationship to the hand because it is the hand, completely is the hand, just as it is. And if it worries about its relationship to the hand, then it's lost the pivot of nothingness. It's off the pivot of nothingness. And Samanta Bhadra has to call it back. Thumb, come back. It's the whole thing. This is it, the whole thing. So that's probably enough, don't you think? The bodhisattvas? Manjushri, to cut away all of our unneeded expectations and desires and worries and anxieties. Maitreya, to help us hope again. We need to hope again. The world is pretty screwed up. Look what's happening. We need to hope again. We need to have the impossible hope. Avalokiteshvara, just to be here with the pain. Just to be here with the pain. For yourself, not just for someone else, for yourself. Just to be here. Just listening to your own crying. You can listen to your own crying, you can listen to someone else's crying. So don't leave yourself out. It's a mantra bhadra who inhabits every pore, regardless of how polluted you think the pore is. There's a little Samanta Bhadra there. A little Samanta Bhadra there encouraging you. So from the pivot of nothingness, lots of things come. Anger, fear, heartache, disappointment, confusion. But if we rest on the pivot, we don't resist them, they don't persist. They don't persist. Very simple practice. Very, very simple. But we need a lot of bodhisattvas to help us, to encourage us, because we don't think it's simple. We think it's complicated. So different bodhisattvas are always coming from different realms to help us, because we complicate things so much. Well, we're dreamers. That's what we are. We're dreamers. We create flowers out of the air. Flowers of air. So, that's our strength and our weakness, right? Strength and our weakness. Questions? Comments? Susan.
Earlier you were saying, talking about people dropping out. And I had a different take on that.
Okay, we'll hear your take.
A turning phrase that Katagiri Roshi had given me was, wherever you go and whatever you do, your practice is with you. And so you're talking about you guys dropping out. But then you said that you're all teachers.
What happened?
So maybe you didn't drop out. Maybe you took a detour.
Oh.
Maybe the seeds were there growing slowly.
Oh.
You run away from the seeds.
Ah, so. Oh, sounds pretty good to me. Thank you. It's funny how life goes, isn't it? Pretty funny. Yeah.
What is the, you said the difference between a healthy dream and one that's not productive? I mean, if I have like the seeds, I think.
Yeah.
What's the test?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Could you guys hear his question? He said, what's the difference between a healthy dream and one that's not so productive? Right? As soon as there's a hint, a taint of obsession to that dream, be careful. It usually means that the dream is getting smaller, is more constrained and more focused on just how I'm gonna change myself. That dream will generally then have its shadow side. It'll turn into a nightmare after a while. But each of us has to observe this with Manjushri's eye and discover for ourselves about it. Even an ego dream has a chance to expand into a big dream. So we need to pay attention and be gentle, be kind, be Avalokiteshvara kind to discover if that dream really has potential or if it's just me, 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 me. Does that make sense?
So you're saying really to try to look at it objectively, be an observer of your dream rather than a participant, and then you can make that judgment it's kind of obsessive.
Yes, but don't try too hard. It's better just to do some zazen, but yes, that's good. to a point. Softly, softly.
It says, gain and loss, right and wrong, away with them all, once and for all.
Uh-huh.
During the Second World War, Japanese Buddhist monks strongly embraced the war machine.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, those monks were what? They were fixated, weren't they?
Right.
So you say something about what you think about that guy.
Well, I'm just wondering. I mean, this is obviously a dilemma.
It's a dilemma because we get fixated on our own, look at nationalism. Some people could say that nationalism and patriotism has been the cause of all these millions and millions of deaths that we have century after century. We get fixated on the dream, right? My. And they were very fixated on their dream of that came from the emperor and that they brought Buddhism in. And they used Buddhism as the Europeans use Christianity, as America uses Christianity, to justify their very egocentric, national-centric, patriot-centric dream, right?
But it suggests something about natural, original Buddha nature that somehow is all clear seeing above right and wrong.
Pardon? I'm not sure what you're saying.
We have an original Buddha nature.
The pivot of nothingness.
The pivot of nothing, exactly.
It's no nature at all. You can call it the Buddha nature or the God nature, but what did Meister Eckhart say? He said, in the Godhead there is no trace of God. No trace of God. So no trace of nationalism, no trace of parochialism in the Godhead, in the pivot of nothingness. Wow, that's your freedom. That's your freedom. You're free at this pivot, on this pivot. You're free. But then we take a step in toward our gratification, our patriotic gratification, our personal gratification, and we bring religion in. Whoops. Whoops. We are in a sorry state, us human beings, aren't we, God? But it's not that sorry. Not that sorry. Because we can always come back to the pivot.
When you were talking about dim vision, on the other hand, it suggested to me that we don't need to see the way clearly.
Mm.
We just have some idea.
That's right.
And follow.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes when I've had the clearest visions about doing things, I get the most attached and I get the most pissed because they don't. But it's been always my dim visions, you know, that have borne fruit. Most human beings are like that. They're really dim, but still it's there. So when I came here from California, and I'm a California boy. Oh, I'm not exactly a boy anymore. when I came here from California, I thought, I had a dim vision of coming here. Linda thought it was just crazy. But I thought, oh, Minnesota. We're both from the San Francisco Bay Area, and coming here and leaving the Zen Center behind, leaving Suzuki behind and Katagiri behind. But I thought, well, Linda went along with me in those days. That's before she decided, enough of these dim visions. I can do a few of these, but that's my wife, you guys. So we came here and we were living in northern Minnesota and I won't get into what we were doing, but I got a wind bell in the mail from San Francisco, San Francisco Zen Center newsletter, and it said, "Oh, saw that Well, first I got one saying that Suzuki Roshi died. That's a whole. But then I got one saying Katagiri was coming to Minnesota. And I said, look, to Linda. And she said, oh, no. Well, I could give you lots of other examples of dim visions.